meaning no day is like your day, O Abu Abdullah. What you heard were the words of a brother to a brother. This phrase was not expressed in a moment of joy, nor was it the giving of tidings of joy. The 7th of Safar draws our attention to these famous words, especially since we continue to be in the state of mourning for history's most blood-curdling tragedy that took place on the 10th of Muharram, known universally as the Day of Ashura. It is the tragedy that occurred in Karbala in Iraq in the year 61 AH, corresponding to 680 AD, when in defense of Islam and humanitarian values, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the Prophet's younger grandson, preferred being martyred in the famous heart-rending manner rather than acknowledge the godless rule of the libertine Yazid. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, whose kunya or agnomen was Abu Abdullah, was hailed along with his elder brother Imam Hassan as the two leaders of the youths of paradise by the Prophet on God's command. Perhaps the question might arise, where was Imam Hassan when Imam Hussein was martyred in Karbala? The answer is obvious. He was already martyred a decade earlier in 50 AH, in Medina through a fatal dose of poison. Who killed Imam Hassan and for what reason? To any person familiar with the early history of Islam, the answer is crystal clear. The Prophet's elder grandson was administered poison on the orders of Muawiyah, the despicable father of the accursed Yazid. Muawiyah, a late and reluctant convert to Islam at the surrender of Mecca in 8 AH, only 2 years before the passing away of the Prophet, was along with his father Abu Sufyan, a staunch enemy of Islam, and had claimed to become a Muslim only to save his life. It is indeed an irony of Islamic history that this same Muawiyah, despite his avowed enmity towards Islam and the Prophet, was within a few years of paying lip service to Islam, appointed governor of Syria by the second caliph. On taking charge of Syria, this charlatan left no stone unturned to weaken the Muslim society from within and distort the teachings of Islam. He refused to step down as governor when he was formally dismissed from that post by the Prophet's righteous heir, the commander of the faithful Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. Muawiyah next came out into open rebellion by starting armed warfare against Imam Ali, peace upon him, but when faced with imminent defeat at the Battle of Siffin, he raised copies of the Holy Quran on spear points to dupe the Muslims and escape alive. After the martyrdom of the commander of the faithful in 40 AH, Muawiyah resorted to a policy of propaganda, terrorism, and bribes against his rightful successor, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him. The Prophet's elder grandson, aware of the flimsy faith of his own army and realizing the magnitude of the treachery of Muawiyah and the dangers of civil war between Muslims at a time when the Christian Byzantine Empire was looking for an opportunity to attack the Islamic realm and seize Baitul Muqaddas, entered into a treaty to avert bloodshed and unmask the hypocrisy of his opponent. Muawiyah, who now took charge of the rule of the Islamic State and conditioned that he would stop the imprecation of the commander of the faithful at mosques, respected tenets of Islam and returned the caliphate to the Prophet's grandson without nominating any successor on his deathbed, contrived to martyr Imam Hassan, peace upon him. In 50 AH, the 10-year imamate of the Prophet's elder grandson came to its sudden end when Muawiyah succeeded in his devilish design of administering a lethal dose of poison mixed in water. The poison rent asunder the liver of Imam Hassan, peace upon him, and he vomited its pieces with blood as death approached. The tragic sight brought tears to the eyes of his younger brother Imam Hussein, peace upon him, who started crying. At this moment, the elder brother foretold to his younger brother, "It is my destiny that I have been poisoned with trickery that would kill me. However, no day is like your day, O Abu Abdullah. On that day, 30,000 hordes from those who claim to be Muslims and part of the Ummah of our grandfather will get together to spill your blood and kill you, take your ladies and children as prisoners, and to plunder your assets. At that time, that God will allow the cursing of the Umayyads, and it will rain blood and ashes from the sky and all creatures, even the wild animals and fish in the sea will cry for you." We therefore mourn Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, on this day, as well as on the 28th of Safar, which according to some narrations was the fateful day of his martyrdom. At any rate, as said earlier, we are in a state of mourning for the immortal martyr of Karbala, and that is the reason we do not celebrate any event during the 2 months of Muharram and Safar. The 7th of Safar also happens to be the birthday of the Prophet's 7th infallible heir, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, but we don't celebrate it out of respect for the martyrdom of his ancestor, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and the tragedy that afflicted the noble ladies and children of his household. As a matter of fact, history is witness that on the advent of the month of Muharram, smile would vanish from the face of Imam Kazem, peace upon him, although almost 100 years separated his era from that of the tragedy of Karbala. On the anniversary of the tragedy of Ashura, the 7th Imam's grief would reach its peak. He would be continuously crying and was heard saying, "This is the day on which Hussein had been killed." As for Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, following his martyrdom, when Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and the Bani Hashim took the coffin towards the Prophet's shrine as a mark of respect before burial in the Baqi cemetery, the despicable Marwan ibn Hakam, who was then governor of Medina, ordered that arrows be shot at the briar. It is said some 70 arrows were shot at the coffin of the Prophet's elder grandson, and several of these arrows pierced his lifeless body. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, endured this insolent oppression with patience and laid Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon him, to eternal rest in the Baqi cemetery near to the grave of his grandmother, Fatima bint Asad, peace upon her. In the subsequent generations, Imam Zainul Abidin, Imam Muhammad Baqir, and Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon them, were laid to rest beside Imam Hassan, peace upon him, and a grand towering mausoleum was built over the blessed tombs where pilgrims used to pay their respects, recite the Holy Quran, and pray to God Almighty. Alas, in 1925, when the heretical Wahhabi hordes of the desert brigand Abdul Aziz ibn Saud seized the land of Revelation Hejaz by shedding torrents of Muslim blood, these savage hordes desecrated and destroyed the holy shrine of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Dear listeners, here we present you some aphorisms from Imam Hassan Mujtaba peace upon him to ponder upon. A blessing is trial if gratitude is shown for it. It becomes a blessing, and if you show ingratitude for it, then it becomes a wrath. One who lacks intelligence has no decorum, and one who lacks determination has no magnanimity, and one who has no modesty has no religion. Abstain from the unlawful and you will be a worshipper, and be content with what Allah has predestined for you, you will be sufficient. Be benevolent to those who take up proximity in your neighborhood. You will be a Muslim. Do not be hasty in punishing someone's sin and leave room between the two, fault and punishment, for apology.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back. This is your favorite program, Back to Reality. I am Asma, at your service as the host, and as usual, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Zainab, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Zahra.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you both in here. And before we get into the core of our discussion and we plunge into it, I would like you to introduce yourself very much short and briefly so that the audience would know you.
Okay, I'm Zainab Askari. I'm master's in linguistics and have studied Hausa in the Jamaat Zahra University.
I'm Zahra Hashimi, and I study computer science, and I attend Hosa as well.
It's a pleasure to have you both in here. And yeah, let's get to the main point of our discussion. Well, death, as the word itself would give you some connotations and impressions, so I would say it seems a little bit of a spooky, dark, gloomy, maybe sad, and a lot of, you know, gloomy-ish sort of things and concepts would come to your mind. Of course, separation and loss and all the things that you would feel in the loss of dear ones. Well, recently I've been thinking about death, and why do we feel scared of death? Why do we think of it as something really sad?
Well, talking about death, not just thinking about it deeply, just hearing the name of death in itself brings a lot of fear and, you know, that scariness within you. And it's because of a lot of reasons. Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi puts it very beautifully in his book, 50 Lessons About Belief for the Youth.
Who is a scholar, of course.
Yeah, and he says that, you know, it's one of the chapters, is the Day of Judgment the end or the start? So in that chapter, the first question he poses is that, why do people fear death? And then gives the reasons. It's because some people fear that it's over, it's the end, because death is the end. it's not the start of a new life. While as Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi explains it very beautifully, that it's a start, basically, start of a new life. It's not the end. So those people who
actually
have this concept...
Actually, the question tells it all, you know? Is it the end or is it the beginning?
Is it the beginning, exactly. Yeah. In fact, he defines the word death as sharbat shirin, which means a sweet drink.
Yeah.
So, you know, to him it sounds sweet because of the many reasons he gives in the book. He says that some people even fear that about the Book of Deeds.
So, Sister Zahra, I suppose the reason that we are scared of death, according to what Sister Zainab said, is the fact that we do not recognize it as a new start, which is going to be eternal.
Also, I think there's also the aspect of the fear of the unknown. People are, in general, afraid of things that they don't know about.
Like
that,
in the dark.
Yeah, like people, even when you've been in the room during the day, you know it's your room, you know nobody's coming, you know there's no monster hiding under the bed. But you turn the lights off and you get scared. Yeah. Because now you can't see.
Though it's your room.
Yeah. Even though you have like a familiar aspect to it.
Exactly.
But
you know each and every angle and corner of that room. Still, when you turn off the light, you feel scared.
Yeah.
So the fear of unknown.
Fear of unknown, yeah.
And probably unpredictable because nobody has come back from there. Nobody came back. So we cannot predict exactly what's happening except for the teachings that we have, except for the sources we have, but people more believe in, like, to hear from the person, hey, you have been there, what was there like?
Exactly.
So since nobody came back from there, so probably from that unknown or unpredictable things.
Exactly, yeah. Well, in generally speaking, I would say that, actually adding to what you have just said, it is true that death is unknown for us, but according to the narrations that we have and according to the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran, there are some hints and clues for people who want to know what's going on in there. But of course, we cannot believe it until we see it. So there remains the fear and the amount of unpredictability that exists in our brain towards the concept of death. And that is the thing that makes it a little bit of scary for us. Actually, not a little bit, too scary for every one of us. But then it depends on our conduct book, the things we have done in our lives and the rest of the story. So right now, I guess it's better for us to go for a sip of water because we're speaking of death. So let's go for a short break and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Thank you. Do not come to my grave and weep. I am not there. I did not sleep. Well, the truth is, we die and it's just going to be the real life. Now, making a child believe this is very difficult. Oh, by the way, you're back to reality. I'm Asma. Sister Zahra and Sister Zainab are there and I'm just enjoying their company. And death is the topic. So as I just told you, I was just thinking, what if a mother starts giving her children a different point of view of death? Would it still be the same for me as that child to be scared of death? Or no, I would change my mind because from the very first square of my life, my parents taught me a different way of looking at death because to them, death is not something that is going to be recognized by the black dresses that every single one wears when somebody dies or all the black themes that comes to your mind.
Right. Well, I think it depends what content parents are conveying to the child. It's very important when, based on that because sometimes you'll find that in our cultures, mostly in the Asian culture, mothers will say to their children like, hey, if you won't do this, you'll be on the day of judgment, you're accountable.
They threaten them with death.
So like this Fave, when this child grows up, he fears death because of facing God's justice. Now his mother has made him clear that Allah is just. He is fair God.
Yeah.
And now he knows that for his all actions, he's accountable and he has to answer in front of God. So sometimes because of that, but depends the way you tell, you know, you have to say God is just because he's, you know.
But according to you, you think that it would make some changes.
It all again, in my when a mother is telling a child that Allah will punish you for this and this thing, she's actually telling him God is just. So beware of your actions. But it also depends the way you say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a way of saying things.
Like saying it with the positive aspects too. Right. Like you do good stuff. Those right. good stuff will have an effect over there. You won't. It's not a horrible place. It's not a scary place. It's very nice. It's like this beautiful park we went to yesterday.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Just defining the negative aspect of the story.
So when somebody dies, if a child asks the elder one, the adults, what happened? Where is she or where is he? The lost one, of course. And they would start saying they've gone to a travel, to a journey they have gone. So I guess this one is a good trick, but still we have to work more and more on that.
Exactly. Like for me, when my great-grandfather died, I was very attached to him and I would ask my parents, where did he go? They would say to me, he went for Hajj.
So yeah, that's right.
A long trip.
Yeah, I was like... it has been years. Why didn't he come back from Hajj? So, you know, even there you have to be telling truth to the child, but in a very creative way.
He would not come back, actually, until you join him.
Yeah.
He's gone on a trip that he's waiting for you.
Exactly.
Yeah, this
in the destination.
Exactly. Fear of the unknown, the unpredictable things that we have no clue about them, our deeds, of course. The amount of things we have done in this world as wrong things, and we know that consciously, but we try to ignore them unconsciously. And then the fact that we do not think of death as a new start that is going to be everlasting forever. There is no pain, there is no worries in that world. These are going to be the main factors of why we are scared of death. So I guess that's enough for right now. Let's go for a short break. And then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Yes, you're back to our round table. We're talking about death, and we actually got to know about some beautiful points to take them into account, because I guess the teachings that we get in our childhood are very important, and the way you've been raised on, very much frequently, they're not going to change as you grow older.
Right.
So from the day one, as a mother, as a father, as the adult, you have to start helping children to build such a very, nice attitude towards death. And it happens, I guess, by practicing and studying too much. And because you yourself as an adult should believe that, okay, death is not going to be the end of me.
We've been so much attached to our possessions in this world.
Very
so
true.
Much attached to the family, friends, loved ones, everything, or whatever belongs to us. We completely forget the life out there is quite smoother than this.
I think a big part of what, you know, creates those attachments in the first place is our ignorance and kind of like how we decide to ignore and not look at death and related topics. I think how we interact with death in our day-to-day life or like in just in our plans has a lot to do with people's perceptions of it. Like as a kid, growing up in America, there were not a lot of graveyards near the place we lived. We would go to a graveyard like once a year in some like far off like desert that was like the Muslim graveyard to visit like my grandfather. And there were just not a lot of graveyards in like near the suburbs, nice places. And I think it had like death became kind of like a
far away
something that people don't interact with other than like once a year.
So that's why we have it in our narrations that we should go visit the cemeteries.
Yeah. And like one thing I noticed after going to like some graveyards over in like in Qom and like some other Islamic countries, was that people have a much better interaction with death. Like people go, it was really cute to me that people would go to like the graveyard of the martyrs and they would go and have picnics there as families. Or like when we would want to go hang out as friends after like school, we would go to the nearby like grave of like a shaheed. And we would just
Which is a peaceful place.
A peaceful place, not a scary place.
Exactly.
The person in front of you is somebody who's tried hard, lived a good life,
and
with all its difficulties.
For the benefit of a country, for the fortune of a nation.
Yeah, and you know, for all those great, like, they reached the like their full potential, you're seeing in front of you somebody who was successful, not somebody who was forgotten, not somebody who was just buried away and disappeared and stuff like that.
So when we actually get to go onto graveyards, to me at least, it's I don't believe that they're dead. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a real city and there's an entire life going on in there. So it just depends on the way you look at it. And truly, according to what you said, depends on your perceptions and how you look at things. The angle you pick to look at things is very important. And it's going to have a really important role in how you're going to define death to yourself and to the next generation. So thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, Sister Zahra. It was so precious for me to be here with you, both of you. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Of course, it was for death, but then death, as we just talked about it, is a new start. So we shall be there and have back to realities as well. Who knows? And yeah, that's
back to reality, same that every soul has to taste death.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, death is not always as just the way we think of it, as this gloomy thing that everybody would think about it. Sometimes it's entirely the reverse, the opposite side of what we just think about it. There are some other different ways of looking at it as well. Thank you very much. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen. يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازك لتصي دليلتك Once again.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe. Istainu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
It was on the journey to Karbala where Imam Hussein alayhi salam is riding his horse along with his family and his companions. And for a moment, he sees a vision in which he hears a cry, and the cry says to him that you are people who are speeding ahead, but death is coming and chasing you, and you are making your way towards Jannah. You're making your way towards paradise. And when the Imam alayhi salam wakes up, he knows that this is an indication that it is only a matter of time before he will be leaving this world. So he cries out, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Now Ali Akbar alayhi salam was the son of the Imam, and he was always close to his father. And when he hears his father cry this cry, he comes to him and he says, "My father, what is wrong?" And the Imam alayhi salam asks him, he narrates to him, you know, the dream or the vision that he had. And then Ali Akbar alayhi salam has a question for his father. He says that, "Afalasna ala al-haq," are we not on the path of the truth? And the Imam alayhi salam says that, "Yes, indeed, by the one who to whom all of us will return." And then Ali Akbar alayhi salam says that famous line, "Idhan la nubali bil maut." If that's the case, then it is not a concern for us that we should have to die. Now at this point, Imam Hussein alayhi salam says something which is very interesting. He doesn't just leave it at that. He doesn't just say that, okay, I agree, and mashallah. What does he say? He says, "May Allah reward you. The best reward that a son can get on account of his relationship with his father." What does that show us, brothers and sisters? It shows us that Ali Akbar alayhi salam didn't just become Ali Akbar just like that. Ali Akbar alayhi salam has a history of a relationship with his father. And at this time, after spending all these years, he has reached the prime of his youth. He's being tested in a way that perhaps no other youth has been tested before. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam is seeing the fruits of this labor. He's seeing the perfect manifestation of what he wants in a son. And then he says that may Allah reward you the best reward that a son can get on account of his relationship with his father. It's this relationship that, inshallah, I want to talk about today. Now remember that we have other examples of relationships. Yesterday we talked about Abdullah, the son of Zubair, and how he was able to control his father, how he was able to manipulate him. Abdullah was somebody who apparently he grew up in a broken home. His father apparently did not take the right strategy when it comes to parenting. And Abdullah's actions were so instrumental in turning history towards darkness and oppression of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. There was one time where the mother of the believers, you know, the wife of the Prophet, that she, on the way to the Battle of Jamal, she hears the sound of the barking dogs. It's a very interesting, she hears the sound of barking dogs. And she asks that, "What is this place right here?" And they tell her that it is the place of the water of Hawab. And when she hears this, she cries out, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." And she says, "Rudduni, rudduni, send me back, send me back. I'm not going forward." So they ask her why. She says that when I heard the dogs barking, it reminded me of an incident that happened many years ago. When the beloved Prophet, when he had all of us gathered and he told us, that, and he told his wives, he said that beware of that incident when the dogs will be barking at the place of water of Hawab. And then he turned to me specifically, he told me that you don't be the one who is in that situation. And I realized that at that time he was predicting what's going to happen right now. So it was going to be over. The first civil war in history was going to be stopped at that point. But who is it that becomes that reason for why this civil war continues? It's Abdullah ibn Zubair. And he comes up and he says, "What's the matter?" She says, "What happened?" He says, "Who told you this is the place of the watering of Ho'ab. She said, that person. He says, okay. He brings 50 people and he has them testify that the place we're in is not Ma'ul Ho'ab, it's some other place. And after that, she's convinced. And they say, you know, Muslim historians from all schools of thought, they say that the first time in Islamic history that somebody actually took an oath on a lie in this manner was Abdullah ibn Zubayr. He turned history against the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So, how do we form this relationship with our children? What is the Islamic basis? What are the Islamic guidelines for this? One of our great scholars, Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, may Allah protect him, he has a beautiful analogy. He says that a family is not made up of individuals who just happen to be in the same location at the same time. He says that, for example, if you want to build a building, because after all, we said yesterday, we quoted the hadith that says that marriage, family is a building. He said, if you want to build a building out of bricks, you don't just get bricks and stack them up, and there you go, you have your home or your building. You can get the best bricks, the highest quality, you know, you can import them from, I don't know, Turkey and get all this nice colors and everything like that. But that itself is not going to build your building. That is the weakest of buildings. Because bricks alone do not make up a building. If you want to have bricks, you have to have something else which is called mortar. Which is that substance which binds the bricks together. Without that mortar, these bricks will just fall apart. What is that mortar? That mortar is the connection that makes us not just be individuals, but rather makes us be a single unit. It's that connection of compassion and love. Now, brothers and sisters, in the modern world, unfortunately, there's many aspects of it which try to rip apart these stitchings and rip us apart and make us into individuals. We're in a world right now which is an individualistic world where people, for the most part, are on their own. And they have to fend for their own and face life's difficulties all on their own. Sometimes even within their home and their marriage, they don't have the support that they need. If you have parents who are trying to connect to you, if they're trying to come and make contact with you and discuss with you and talk to you, if they're interested in your life, which they should be, if they want to take you out, which they should, please do not be somebody who says that I'm okay. I'm fine with my phone and my friends and my social media. Because all those will not be there for you when you really need them to. And your parents will bend their backs backward. They'll sacrifice their own life to make sure that you're happy. This is what the type of values that we learn from Karbala, that if it comes to family, we will never abandon each other, even when the times are dire. We're all going to be together. We don't have a single example of one of the family members saying that, Dad, Mom, I'm okay. I'm going to do things on my own here. No, they're in it together. And that comes about by wanting to have that connection.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyim محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Part 1. Sky may be the only place you can find peace in Afghanistan. Because from up here, bad incidents become so small that they're not visible anymore. If the only criterion is people, life in Afghanistan goes on, like anywhere else in the world. In here, people live together despite their differences. In today's Afghanistan, it doesn't matter if life goes on fast or slowly. In here, incidents set the cycle of life in motion, or even stop it. People have no role in these incidents. The incidents come to the country from outside. The problem in Afghanistan today is these incidents. If you type Afghanistan in Google, you'll come across many military and horrible incidents. This is the United Nations Happiness Index for different countries. In 2020, Afghanistan ranked last on the list of all the countries in the world. This report reveals a bitter reality. The question is, what put Afghanistan in this situation in recent years? Maybe if we go back 2 decades in time, we can find an answer to our question. 2 decades before 2021 was 2001. Afghanistan's destiny changed that year.
Moments later, the president walked in.
Yeah, it was interesting.
On September 11th, 2001, then U.S. President George Bush was visiting a school. His worried face revealed that something concerning had happened. At 8:46 a.m., the first tower was targeted. At 9:03 a.m., the second tower was hit. A major event was unraveling. 4 suicide missions with passenger planes in a single day. 9:37 a.m., the Pentagon. 10:03 a.m., an explosion and a plane crash in Pennsylvania. According to Bush, everything was clear and obvious. But was this really the reality?
Who attacked our country? The evidence we have gathered all points to a collection of loosely affiliated terrorist organizations known as Al-Qaeda. This group and its leader, a person named Osama bin Laden.
Bob Graham, former governor of Florida, and the head of the 9/11 fact-finding commission. The commission made a detailed report on the terrorist attacks in 2003. Parts of the report were published. It's known as the 28-page document. The role of Saudi Arabia and the Bush administration was a fact Bob Graham and his colleagues highlighted.
The release of the 28 pages received a variety of interpretations. There were some who said that this confirmed the Saudi link to the 9/11 hijackers. Did these 19 people, most of whom did not speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, most of whom were not well educated, did they carry out this sophisticated task alone, or did they have some form of support while they were in the United States? If the answer is they had some support, who provided that support?
A hidden network that spread from Riyadh to the White House. At the head of the network, there was a Saudi man named Bandar bin Sultan. He was Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S. from 1983 to 2005. He was the head of the National Security Council for some time. He was also the head of the Saudi spy agency from 2012 to 2014. His influence in the Bush administration paved the way for the tragic event. This picture dates back to September 13, 2001, 2 days after the September 11th attacks. Bandar bin Sultan, along with Bush and his team, are on the Truman balcony of the White House.
Almost 3,000 American victims and their families deserve justice. They deserve the right in a court of law to be able to present the evidence that they have gathered, which is voluminous, that will link the kingdom and other entities of Saudi Arabia to the 19 hijackers.
All the fact-finding commission was saying was Saudi Arabia was behind the 9/11 attacks. But the most obvious question is, then why did the U.S. attack Afghanistan immediately after the 2001 attacks? If the U.S. was supposed to attack somewhere, it should have been Saudi Arabia, not Afghanistan.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
On October 7, 2001, the CIA Special Forces were the first Americans who entered Afghanistan via Pakistan, and the large-scale aerial attacks followed afterwards. From New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania to Kabul, Herat, and Kandahar, the false flag 9/11 attacks were the excuse to rein in the impoverished country. Afghanistan had no role in what had happened. It's really interesting that Fox News saying, according to a survey, 92% of the youth in Afghanistan have not even heard anything about the 9/11 attacks. The U.S. did not set foot in Afghanistan for the first time in 2001, but it was the early 1980s. The importance of Afghanistan's oil and gas reserves in Central Asia started a new rivalry between the Soviet Union and the U.S.
Massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies.
In 1979, the Soviet forces occupied Afghanistan. Carter immediately tasked the CIA with taking countermeasures. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, came up with a scheme. He decided to deploy some radical and Arab militia forces in Afghanistan.
We know of their deep belief in God, and we are confident that their struggle will succeed. That land over there is yours. You'll go back to it one day because your fight will prevail, and you'll have your homes and your mosques back again because your cause is right and God is on your side.
On the other hand, he decided to organize the domestic militia forces. Money, weapons, and extremism. It was a dangerous combination.
When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, we had this brilliant idea that we were going to come to Pakistan and create a force of Mujahideen, equip them with Stinger missiles and everything else to go after the Soviets inside Afghanistan. And we were successful. The Soviets left Afghanistan, and then we said, great, goodbye, leaving these trained people who were fanatical in Afghanistan and Pakistan, leaving them well armed.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S., sought to export the Wahhabi ideology to Afghanistan through Arab militants. One of its clear examples was bin Laden. As a Saudi national, he was linked to the powerful Saudi network.
Let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's great, let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam.
In the end, it was the Afghan people who fell victim to the war between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The tragic thing was extremist Wahhabism crept into Afghanistan.
Their support for the 9/11 hijackers has been to encourage Saudi Arabia to be involved in more of the same. They've continued to fund al-Qaeda. They were a significant part of the establishment of ISIS. They have supported madrasas, which teach young people hatred and intolerance, of mosques, which preach jihad to adults. All those things have happened after 9/11.
The U.S. and Saudi support for radicalism in Afghanistan did not end with extremist militias or al-Qaeda. Daesh was a new disaster that came to Afghanistan. Hundreds of dead and wounded was the result of Daesh presence in Afghanistan.
Why was it that this extremism came from your schools and from your mosques?
And in part, I blame ourselves also in hindsight. Because are there things that we could have done? Probably. But at the time that this was all, that all these forces were being unleashed, you deal with them at the time.
Under such circumstances, and due to the insecurity in Afghanistan, although the U.S. had spent over $2 trillion in the country from 2001 to 2021, it failed to restore minimum peace to the country. To get a clear picture of how big the number is, think of, for example, $62 billion. It is almost equal to the U.S.'s annual budget needed to stay in Afghanistan. It is more than the entire U.K. military budget and more than the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's budget. After the massive failure in Afghanistan, Trump decided to put an end to U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Why are we there? We're 6,000 miles away. Where Taliban is here, ISIS is here, and they're fighting each other. I said, why don't you let them fight? Why are we getting in the middle of it? I said, let them fight. They're both our enemies. Let them fight. They go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
With Trump's strategy, it was predictable that he would face major differences with the U.S. military commanders. The top military official regarding Afghanistan was General James Mattis.
Do you agree that we're not winning in Afghanistan?
Sir, I understand the urgency. I understand it's my responsibility. We're not winning in Afghanistan right now.
He confessed to the failure in Afghanistan and believed that the process of failure had been expedited because of Trump's measures. That's why Trump was dissatisfied with General Mattis more than anyone else. As he was a businessman, Trump's economic approach was meant to make profits in Afghanistan, or at least make up for the money spent in the country. Blackwater is a notorious name among private security contractors. Eric Prince was the director of the firm and Trump's unofficial military advisor. Prince tried to provide an answer for Trump in Afghanistan. He presented Trump with a plan to tackle the financial loss in Afghanistan. First of all, Eric Prince knew well that the U.S. Army has failed in Afghanistan.
The mighty U.S. military
the most powerful and expensive military in the history of mankind, gets defeated by largely illiterate goat herders using very simple weapons, AKs, PKs, Dishkas, and homemade explosives. Please, be honest with ourselves. Who could say that our 17 years, trillions of dollars, 2,400 U.S. dead, tens of thousands of wounded has been a raging success? I would disagree.
Secondly, privatizing the Afghan war by Eric Prince would tremendously reduce the costs.
I've laid out this plan, this alternative, that comes in at less than 8% of what the Pentagon is spending.
Thirdly, the role of Afghanistan mineral deposits in generating revenues and making up for the war expenditure.
Look, I've got a lot of other things. I spend most of my time mining and looking for natural resources in weird places of the world. This would be a passion project. The private sector can do this. The business of America is business. It's not warfare. We've been looking for minerals, and there is an enormous mineral and energy potential in Afghanistan if you could just set security long enough. Okay, so if you have a reliable battalion in the area that can pacify an area, then you can attract the private capital to build.
So Eric Prince's alternative plan for Trump was a meaningful combination of the mines and the privatization of the Afghan war.
Now he's president. He's saying, well, they've got like $1 trillion of minerals in Afghanistan. Why don't we at least take it to pay for the war? No, that would be stealing. That would be robbing from them. Trump thinks, well, I don't like the option of leaving anymore. I don't like the option of putting in more troops. Mm-hmm. And he's, in other words, biding his time to introduce the option of, why don't we just give it to my friend Eric Prince and let him make billions of dollars off of it? That way the millions he gave us will be repaid by billions from taxpayers.
Mines and Trump were the two keywords that were meaningful in Afghanistan. Wilbur Ross was Trump's Secretary of Commerce. His interview gave a clear picture of Trump's approach toward mines in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, it hasn't gotten, I mean, the president obviously gave his big speech recently about sending more troops there. You delivered a plan this summer to the president to get the Afghanistan economy back on its feet that relies in part on tapping into the country's estimated $1 trillion in mineral resources, trillion even by Washington standards, right, as you said, a lot of money. The president has said we can use some of those resources to repay us for what we've spent there. Where does the plan stand, and are we going to be able to benefit from that?
A few years ago, the U.S. Geological Survey did a survey of Afghanistan. It concluded that there was about $1 trillion of natural resources, not counting oil and gas, so copper, lithium, minerals of those sort. That's a big number. And then ultimately getting some big international mining firms to come in and do the job.
Yeah.
But what really goes on in these silent and far-fetched mountains?
We're not a new kid on the block when it comes to Afghanistan. Our first work in Afghanistan started in 1952. And we were there until about 1973. One of the things that we discovered when we started work is that there was a huge amount of mineral data available within the Ministry of Mines and Industries at that time and within the Afghan Geological Survey. This was mostly old Soviet data that went back to... We used the old Soviet data to compile the first assessment of what we call the preliminary assessment of the mineral resources of the country. That was completed in 2010. We were approached by the Department of Defense and said, and they asked us whether or not, or how could they basically increase interest in the development of these mineral resources in these boxes. And we told them, we normally do not go beyond what you see, but if you want to increase the interest, then you need to go into each one of the boxes and develop detailed information and data. We did that. This block map basically includes metallic minerals, industrial minerals, and locations for gemstones or precious stones. So it's a full look at the mineral resource assessment as we look at them in USGS. That confirmed basically that we were right in our assessment because we found what we should have found there.
I'm a teacher.